But I felt a great loss here because he was one of those quiet, dependable people, and he earned the respect of his men. Another sergeant we lost, his name was Sergeant Monty. He was a very unfortunate individual because he was giving bombing instruction. One of his men threw a bomb, and it was live bombs at this time, even on instruction. It hit a piece of wire and catapulted back and killed him. And this was something that could never have been foreseen at any time. But the saddest of all, in my opinion, of those we knew so well and on whom we could depend, was Sergeant Mackenzie. He really was an awfully nice man, and he had such an aptitude and a penchant for chocolate that we called him the Chocolate Soldier, although he was a most efficient man. And he always looked, even if we were up to our neck in mud, somehow old Mac always looked as though he'd just stepped out of a bandbox. And here again, sad to relate, he was killed. And before we put him in a winding sheet and I buried him personally, I parted his hair and straightened him up. And but for a bullet wound in the back, you wouldn't have known that he was even dead. But I shall never forget him. He was one of my best pals, and when these things happen, it's just another notch of bitterness that remains. I'm very interested in your documentary, Mr. Brown, and I sincerely hope that it may run for several weeks in parts. This I'm not aware of or what you intend to do, but it would seem such a pity, although I feel instinctively that one doesn't want to dwell on war indefinitely. On the other hand, I feel that an event of such magnitude as you are now trying to commit to a television series or program is so important that these younger generation, if they followed it and realized what actually happens in war, and this from the lips of the men who actually experienced it, then I feel that you're doing a wonderful service to humanity by bringing home to them the need for vigilance and the need to avoid apathy. And whether they like it or not, we are all politically motivated, irrespective of the party banner under which one would serve. Because politics are bound up with economics. And when I hear the wise ones on the panel, each stating their view of the economic situation, it puzzles me to realize that however highly placed the people who are on the particular panel might be, or the experience they might have had in very high office, there's one fault that they all seem to indulge in, and that is they say that we must increase our exports and reduce our imports. Well, if they were economists and true economists, they would realize that that's a contradiction in terms, simply because we are an island people and we have very few raw materials. And if we are to increase our exports, in order to do this, we must buy the raw material to produce the finished article. Therefore, the more you export, the more you must import. So it's quite impossible for the dog to ever catch up in trying to catch his tail, because it can't be done. And I'm very surprised that intelligent people fall into that trap, and they think that that's the cure-all for all our troubles. But actually, that is something that cannot be overcome. And strange as it may sound, I say this advisedly, that the true economist will tell you that if you want to reduce inflation, you must have unemployment, because it's a physical impossibility to increase labour force without increasing labour costs. And the higher the ratio of employment, the greater the number of labour intakes, with the result that they themselves, when they commence work again, they're already pressing for more money, and we're coming back to the same situation as we find ourselves in now, and that is, you cannot possibly reduce inflation unless you increase unemployment, despite the whatever the unions may say. It may surprise you to know that although the heliograph, which as you know is a signal appliance, and which it really should be used in countries where you have quite a lot of sun, but I was using one of these in the trenches. In fact, I was using two, because I'd sighted one in the bottom of the trench and was guiding it onto another heliograph which was above ground in order to get the information back. In addition to which, of course, we used to carry a panniers of carrier pigeons with us when we went into the line, and this enabled us to send the birds back to the Luffs in the brigade headquarters, and we had some magnificent birds there, blue checkers, lovely creatures, and we would sign a message on very thin paper, roll it up and put it in a tiny aluminium capsule and gently press it onto the bird's leg without any discomfort to the creature, and I would go behind a pillbox and just release the bird, and we were very fortunate. The birds always homed, although the enemy tried their utmost sometimes to stop them. And speaking of pillboxes, or amoebas as they called them, the enemy were for everlastingly using the cement mixers. You could hear them working, and in no time at all they'd built up a pillbox which the biggest naval shell would not wreck, because they used to be so thick, and it's very, very difficult to destroy them. But as the war went on, from time to time we'd make little sorties, and we were able to capture a pillbox here and a pillbox there. But the difficulty there was that when we captured them, the entrance was in the front and not in the rear, and we had great difficulty at times in getting into them, as the enemy had them sighted so well, and they were often great hazards. But I was in one on one occasion when a Sergeant Watts was brought in. He had the calf of his leg blown away, poor fellow, and he was in a dreadful state. And no sooner he'd been brought in than a rather heavy shell dropped on top of our Mavis. And although we were fortunate in the sense that the blast went outwards instead of inwards, and but for a shower of dust and grit, we were quite well, and I was able to get poor Watts down to the casualty clearing station despite a terrific bombardment, and we handed him over to doctors there, and I did learn that ultimately he was able to get back quite safely to England, and he ultimately had an amputation, and to the best of my knowledge he still survives, which is a good thing. Of course, Passchendaele was, as I've described earlier in the tape, was really an awful place. All we had to walk on were duck boards, and because you'd be up to your neck in mud, nothing you could do about that. And the enemy had really tremendous artillery power there, which they used to fire from the woods at the back, and there were more gun battles, I should think, on this sector than on any part of the Western Front, as far as I know. And although Ypres was on the right, that was blown about quite a bit. And I should mention here that I became a member of the Ypres League of Officers and Men who served at Ypres from 1914 to 1918. And we somehow survived despite some very bad bombardment from time to time. I also recall on one occasion that a shell came over and killed three of our men, each of whom had a family of several children. And I well remember remarking to another man that that shell has made 34 orphans in less than a split second of time.